Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on House of Bush, House of Saud, right after this message. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. We've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said that he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who couldn't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as a plumber or carpenter who can't fix his own pipes or his own steps. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about lawyers and law school students. He said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And it's worse than that," he said. "Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom and without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax." Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School, the fourth largest law school in the United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, the school is available on compact disc for adult home education. Just call for more particulars. But if you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing House of Bush, House of Saud, written by Craig Unger, copyright 2004 by Scribner & Company. The ISBN number 0-7432-5337-X. Now, this book is a blockbuster, to say the least. I call it a 1 in 100 book. You'll read 100 books before you'll read another story like this. Documented from beginning to end with a complete bibliography and footnotes to identify all of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. Well, in 1998, Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, along with 16 other prominent neoconservatives from a group called the Project for a New American Century, also known as PNAC, they lobbied President Clinton to remove Saddam Hussein and his regime from power. But rather than overthrow Saddam, Clinton continued a policy of containment through periodic airstrikes. Well, by the time George W. Bush put together his team of advisors in 1999, several of its key members, including his brother, Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, as well as Perle and Wolfowitz, had signed on to the Project for a New American Century. Now, untutored as he was in foreign policy, Bush's own positions on crucial issues in the Middle East were not yet fully formed. But now the hardline neocons had his ear. And picking up from Wolfowitz's defense planning guidance paper that he had published back in the first Gulf War, they put forth a grandiose vision for American foreign policy for the 21st century. The language used in their reports was the language of the world through the process of domination. Now, one such PNAC report referred admiringly to Wolfowitz's infamous work as a blueprint for maintaining global U.S. preeminence, precluding the rise of a great power rival like China or Russia, and shaping the international security order in line with American principles and interests, and asserted that its judgments were still sound. That Bush was amenable to some of the same Middle East policies that his father had rejected was not widely known to the public, but it was not entirely secret either. In November of 1999, Pearl, by then an advisor to Bush, told the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette that the candidate, George Bush, was drafting a speech calling for Saddam Hussein's removal from power. And he added that Bush's speech would be critical of Clinton, and it would say that it's time to finish the job. It's time for Saddam Hussein to go. Well, when the presidential race got underway in 2000, however, no such statements ever proceeded out of the mouth of George W. Bush. Now, for all of the firepower behind Bush's candidacy for his nomination was not a foregone conclusion, because on February 1, 2000, insurgent Arizona Senator John McCain won the crucial opening primary in New Hampshire. He beat Bush by 19 percentage points. Now, McCain, an authentic Vietnam War hero who had been a long-time prisoner of war in North Vietnam, had cast himself as a crusading Pied Piper leading his horde of McCainiacs, as he called them, around the country on a bus that he called the Straight Talk Express. McCain's challenge brought out Bush's true colors. The next major primary state was South Carolina. It's one of the most conservative in the Union. And Bush retaliated aggressively by painting the conservative McCain as a liberal. He blitzed the state with brutal attack ads on TV and radio, and in print and by telephone. He appeared before thousands of evangelicals at Bob Jones University. Bob Jones, remember, is the fundamentalist college that had banned interracial dating. He declined to endorse the Republican governor's opposition to flying the Confederate flag above the State House. Thousands of voters got phone calls asserting that McCain's wife had mob ties, that McCain had illegitimate children, that he had a black child, and that there had been an abortion in McCain's family. Then a group of Bush supporters called Republicans for clean air, spent $2.5 million on commercials attacking McCain and distorting McCain's record on the environment. The ads went on to say that McCain opposed breast cancer research and through his sister, or although his sister was fighting the disease at that time. Astonished by the ferocity of the attacks, McCain told a reporter, "They know no depths, do they? They absolutely know no depths." But Bush's tactics proved successful, and on February the 19th, he trounced McCain 53% to 42% in South Carolina. 3 weeks later, on the March 7th Super Tuesday primaries, Bush won California, Ohio, Georgia, Missouri, and Maryland to all but lock up the Republican nomination for the 2000 presidential election year. Now, if the vitriol from the Bush campaign did not poison the body politic across the United States, it was because when it came to the care and the feeding of the press, there was no candidate that season that could surpass George W. Bush, the consummate politician. And as he traveled about the country by bus, plane, and train, Bush joshed with reporters about their romances, and he handed out nicknames to his pet journalists, and he put his arm around them and slapped them on the back, and he passed out cookies and treats. In a documentary that she did for HBO, Journey with George, NBC television producer Alexandra Pelosi said that after George Bush and his staff bought her 4 birthday cakes, and her network didn't buy her one, she started to wonder, just who am I working for anyway? Well, she wasn't the only journalist who was being wooed by Bush. We were writing about trivial stuff because he charmed the pants off of us, explained Richard Wolff, who covered the campaign for London's Financial Times. He said that whenever Bush journeyed to the back of the press bus, explaining earnestly how much he loved a good bologna sandwich, making corny jokes, giving a young woman an orange, and then telling her, "You're the orange of my eye." Reporters went weak in the knees, Wolff added. And thanks to such warm relations with the media, Bush repeatedly turned his liabilities into assets. He's a poor public speaker, and he made one verbal gaffe after another. Bush played the self-deprecating common man under fire by the know-it-all intellectuals of the Eastern liberal establishment. Intimate with the wise men of Washington since childhood, Bush, one of the greatest political dynasties in American history, George Bush was even able to sell himself as an outsider to power. He said on Face the Nation, "My zip code is 78701, referring to his Austin, Texas address. It's not Washington, D.C. And if you call me on the telephone, it'll be area code 512, not 202. Now, at one campaign stop after another, Bush delivered the same canned speeches asserting that his priorities were his faith and his family. And reporters dutifully did his bidding. "I have not learned one single thing about his policies or about George Bush," said Wayne Salter, a Dallas Morning News reporter who had covered Bush for many years in Texas and followed him during the primaries. "We were all like lemmings. We follow the Bush campaign like lemmings and do exactly what they tell us. On the rare occasion when they did not obey and they dared to probe beneath the surface, reporters learned the hard way the high price that they'd have to pay. They would be denied access to the candidate, access that was the lifeblood of a Washington journalist's career. Example, when Alexandra Pelosi asked Bush if he was certain that every prisoner executed on his watch as Texas governor was guilty, Bush, who had flirted with her throughout the campaign, suddenly became brusque. He gave a terse answer and later chastised her for violating the rules of engagement. He said, 'I'm not answering your questions.' And he told her afterward, 'You came after me the other day and you went below the belt.' And so Pelosi backed off. 'Because all of our careers are tied to George Bush,' she said. Like the rest of the press corps, she had realized that tangling with Bush was bad for business. She said, 'If I throw him a hard ball, he'll push me into the outfield, and it's my job to maintain my network's relationship to the candidate and report on him every day.' So as a result, she scripted and fabricated reality that had been put together by Karl Rove and his team, and then disseminated that information that was spoon-fed to them, the entire media, and they did it virtually unchallenged. Now, in the bright lights of the mass media, tens of millions of Americans saw Bush as the candidate of the common man. He was a Washington outsider, a moderate, a centrist, a compassionate conservative. Well, the more complex reality wasn't part of the picture. Very few people saw him as he was, as a candidate of big oil. He was the ultimate insider, and he was a radical conservative who was closely tied to the evangelical right and to the hawkish neoconservative defense policymakers. In Harper's Magazine, Joe Connison raised compelling questions about Bush's rise to riches and his ties to the oil industry. A handful of small liberal publications followed suit. A publication called the Intelligence Newsletter, a tiny publication with a keen eye on the intelligence community, had a very weak grasp of the animates of American politics. They reported on Bush's close ties to the Saudis. But those were very rare exceptions. Even the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania had not put terrorism on the radar screen for the average American. No major media outlet asked about Bush's ties to the Saudis or to the Carlyle Group and how that might affect dealing with the forces of terror in the future. Now, if the Saudis had been happy with the presidency of his father, George H.W. Bush, and they certainly were, they must have been truly ecstatic that his son was the Republican candidate for president in 2000. Indeed, the relationship between the two dynasties had come a long way since the 1970s. Now, the Bushes and their allies controlled, influenced, or possessed substantial positions in a vast array of companies that dominated the energy and the defense sectors. Now, when you put it all together, there were myriad ways for the House of Bush to engage in very lucrative business deals with the House of Saud and the Saudi merchant elite. The Saudis gave donations to Bush-related charities. They invested in the Carlyle Group, funds or contracts with one of the companies owned by Carlyle in the defense sector or other industries. James Baker's law firm, Baker Botts, represented both the giant oil companies who did business with the Saudis as well as the defense contractors who sold weapons to them. Its clients also included Saudi insurance companies and the Saudi American Bank. It negotiated huge natural gas projects in Saudi Arabia. It even represented members of the House of Saud itself, and the firm's role was not limited to merely negotiating contracts. When global energy companies needed to devise policies for the future, when government bodies required attention, Baker Botts was always there. And the Saudis were also linked to Dick Cheney through Halliburton, the giant Texas oil exploration company that had huge interests in the kingdom. Now, how much did all of this come to? What was the number? Where did the money go? Well, with the understanding that the sums were paid by both individuals and entities to both individuals and entities for diverse purposes at different times, it's difficult to follow the money, but it's not impossible. So, in charitable contributions, along with business deals with the Bushes, with corporations like the Carlyle Group and Harkin Oil, the total was about $1.5 billion. That's $1.5 billion. And it made its way from the Saudis to the House of Bush and its allied companies and institutions, and it could safely be said that never before in history had a presidential candidate, much less a presidential candidate and his father, who was a former president, been so closely tied financially and personally to the ruling family of another foreign power. And never before had a president's personal fortunes and public policies been so deeply entwined with another nation. And what were the implications of all of this? Well, in the case of George Bush Sr., close relations with the Saudis had at times actually paid dividends for America. And certainly in terms of the Saudi cooperation during the Gulf War, for example. But that carried with it a very high price. The Bushes had religiously observed one of the basic tenets of Saudi-American relations, and that is that the United States would not poke its nose into Saudi Arabia's internal affairs. Now, that might have been fine if it was a Western democracy like Great Britain, Germany, or Spain, but by the late 90s, it was clear that Saudi Arabia, as much as any other country in the world, was responsible for the rise of Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. And now that the Islamists were killing Americans in the Khobar Towers and bombing them in Kenya and Tanzania, America's national security was involved. And what had previously been considered a purely domestic issue for the Saudis, the House of Saud's relationship to these extremist Islamic groups, was now a matter of America's national security. Hundreds had already been killed by Saudi-funded terrorists, and yet former President Bush and James Baker continued their lucrative business deals with the Saudis, apparently, without asking the most fundamental of questions. Now, of course, George Bush was closing in on the White House, and it remained to be seen how, if he was elected, he was going to deal with the Saudis and the global terrorist threat. Federal election laws prohibit foreign nationals from funding American political candidates. But the Saudis were not like last-minute holiday shoppers. They had begun buying their American politicians many years in advance. The close relationships between these two great dynasties was not the only factor that might interfere with Bush's acting against this growing terrorist threat. You see, the Republicans had just awakened to the fact that there were about 7 million Muslims in America, as many or more than there were Jews. Now, the Jewish population in the electorate votes almost like the blacks for the Democratic candidates. The Muslims in 1996 had gone for Clinton about 2-1. Could it be that the Muslims could be converted to the Republican camp? Because 7 million Muslims is a huge pool of voters who had largely been ignored by both political parties. So to remedy that, Bush campaign strategist Grover Norquist came up with an aggressive plan to win them over by making alliances with groups run by Islamic fundamentalists. He invented the notion of a Muslim-American electoral bloc. Norquist is a bearded, stocky, Harvard-educated intellectual who described himself as a right-winger. Norquist gained notoriety in the 90s at the right hand of Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. Now that's when Gingrich and his power was at its zenith. But when Gingrich's star fell, Norquist moved on and hitched his wagon to two of the most powerful conservatives in Washington, Tom DeLay and Dick Armey. Now, as the president of Americans for Tax Reform, Norquist was a founding member of the Islamic Institute, a nonprofit foundation promoting Muslim political movements. His Muslim partner, Khalid Safuri, was deputy director of the American Muslim Council, also known as the AMC, and had an extensive network of contacts with other Muslim American leaders. Now, on the surface, Norquist's stratagem to win the Muslim American vote had a powerful political appeal. You see, Muslims had voted 2-1 for Clinton back in 96. Clinton was actively engaged in the peace process in the Middle East, and the Muslims felt that Clinton was even-handed. But Norquist argued that the Muslims could easily be won over to the Republican side. It is axiomatic that come election time, every American presidential candidate rallies wholeheartedly behind Israel. But the Republicans could make the case that Bush's ties to the oil lobby made him more receptive to Arab and Muslim concerns. In addition, his father had been relatively hard on Israel and had, back in 1991, threatened to suspend loans to Israel in an effort to stop ongoing Israeli settlements in Palestinian territory. That was a sense that the Bush people played up to. "I'm my father's son, and people like that," said James Zogby. He's the head of the Arab American Institute, who served as a Gore advisor during the campaign. Finally, and perhaps most important, when Al Gore picked a Jewish running mate, Joe Lieberman, the Muslims in America became much more receptive to the Republicans. Now, one problem with Norquist's strategy, however, was that Muslim Americans are not a homogeneous ethnic group. Many are African Americans who converted to Islam. Many are immigrants from Pakistan, India, Iran, Africa, and the Middle East. Less than 20% of American Muslims are of Arab descent. So among Arab Americans, there are Arabs who immigrated before the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and who are, usually, moderate, and there are Muslims who came recently. They are likely to be more Islamic fundamentalists. There are many different Islamic sects, like Christianity. They're divided up into many groups, and each one of these groups has a different agenda. And finally, even though the vast majority of Muslim Americans are moderates who are well integrated into American society, many of the biggest and most powerful Muslim organizations in the United States are run by Wahhabi Islamic fundamentalists. Now, the inordinate influence of Wahhabi Islam in the American Muslim community dates back to the 1980s, when the Saudis saw an opportunity to gain sway over the burgeoning new Islamic community in the United States by establishing what author Stephen Schwartz calls the Wahhabi Lobby. In many ways, Schwartz says, to win political power in America, the Saudis chose to replicate the model created by influential Jewish and Israeli lobbying groups. So, with Saudi backing, American Muslims started organizations like the Council on American-Islamic Relations, known as CAIR, which was similar to the Anti-Defamation League. Then they made the American Muslim Council, known as the AMC, which was modeled on the American Jewish Committee. The Muslim Public Affairs Council, the MPAC, which was similar to the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And on it went. Now, as Schwartz points out in congressional testimony, the generous Saudi support of Islam in the United States could easily be documented on the official website of the Saudi embassy. In 1995, the Saudi government reported $4 million in donations to construct a mosque complex in Los Angeles, named for one of the forefathers of Wahhabism. The same year, the website reported a $6 million donation for a mosque in Cincinnati, Ohio. Then in 1999, the Saudis helped CAIR buy land for its Washington, D.C. headquarters. In 2000, the kingdom contributed to Islamic centers and mosques in Washington, Los Angeles, Fresno, Denver, and Harrison, New York. In all, Schwartz estimated that over many years, the Saudis have given at least $324 million to mosques and Islamic groups in the United States. As a result, out of thousands of mosques in the United States, estimates range from about 1,200 to as high as 6,000. Nobody seems to know. But as many as 80% of these mosques have now come under Wahhabi control. And according to Schwartz, that means having authority over property, buildings, appointment, and training of the imams, the preachers, and the contents of preaching, and the distribution of Friday sermons, and they come from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and of literature distributed in those mosques and those mosque bookstores. Now, innocent as such charitable contributions may sound, in fact, they were effectively a continuation of the same global apparatus that had created and funded Al-Qaeda. Now, far from being confined to the Middle East, such charitable funding went to the Muslims all over the world, including the United States. This was money that went not just to fund terrorist activities, but to support thousands of mosques, schools, and Islamic centers that were dedicated to the jihad movement in non-Muslim countries. Now, just how rigorous Schwartz was in arriving at his figure of $324 million in Saudi funding is unclear, but other sources suggest that his estimate is not an exaggeration. Because according to U.S. News and World Report, since 1975, the Saudis have allocated a total of $70 billion. That's B with a, billion, $70 billion to this international campaign of lobbying worldwide. That makes the Saudi program, according to Alexiev of the Center for Security Policy, a Washington think tank, the biggest worldwide propaganda campaign in history, far bigger than the Soviet propaganda efforts at the height of the Cold War. The Saudis have spent more money on lobbying and propaganda efforts than have the Russians and the communists. You know, that's pretty significant. And we'll be back when we take a break. We got to take a break here. We'll be back, and we'll take a look at Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. And I'll show you the connecting link between Bible prophecy and international geopolitics. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities free from government surveillance. You know, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years now, have we? That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from the political process or the politicians, the lawyers, or the bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, "You give me the judicial power and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of the courts, why don't you call the law school at area code 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Remember, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, the school, is available on compact disc with all of the paperwork for home education. Now, if you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, there's no doubt but what the Arab vote or the Muslim vote in America was very significant in the 2000 election. Like every other group that contributed to Bush's victory in 2000, the Islamists realized that the tiny margin of victory in Florida had increased their leverage. Aga Saeed, the AMPCC chairman, said that it won't be long before political analysts realize that Muslim voters have played a historic role in this election. And Sami El-Aryan, the engineering professor at University of South Florida, who had referred to Jews as monkeys and pigs, asserted that the role of the Muslim vote in Florida was crucial, even decisive. And the party regulars in the Republican Party agreed, as Tom Davis, he's the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, put it, "Without the Muslim endorsements, Florida would have been reversed." In other words, without the mobilization of the Saudi-funded Islamic groups in America, and particularly Florida, George W. Bush would not be president today. Now, how does this fit into Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy just a good guess written hundreds of years ago as to how events would transpire hundreds of years later? Or is Bible prophecy actually an ongoing phenomenon that is brought to pass by someone who has the power to do that? For instance, if I say, "I'm going to prophesy. On Wednesday, I'm going to drive to Springfield." I can bring that prophecy to pass because I have a vehicle and I can get in it and I can start it and I can operate it and I can drive it to Springfield. Now, you might say, "Well, that's not much of a prophecy. I mean, you've got the power to do that, and so do I." But Bible prophecy is a little different in that you don't have the power to destroy the United States of America. There are forces around the world that would like to accomplish that goal. And surprisingly, there's a chapter in the Bible that talks about the United States of America and our destruction. In fact, it's aimed at the House of Israel. Now listen to this story, and let's see if we can put two and two together. Deuteronomy 28, the first 14 verses, tell us about the benefits. If you do this, that, and another thing, I'm going to give you these benefits. Well, we've gotten those benefits. You can see that that prophecy has come to pass. We Americans and Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, and the Western democracies of Western Europe, we have received those benefits. We are the number one power in the world as a race of people. The Chinese are now challenging us. They want to be the race that takes over dominance of the world. The Europeans are vying for the position that America now holds as the number one superpower in the world. In verse 15, God told Moses to write this down. He said, "It'll come to pass, if you will not hearken unto the voice of the Eternal your God, to observe to do all of his commandments and all of his statutes which I command you this day, that all of these curses shall come upon you and overtake you." So it's a quid pro quo. You do this, and here's the benefits you're going to get, and if you don't do this, here's the curse you're going to receive. I remember that as a boy. My dad used to say, "You do these chores, and you do this work, and we'll go hunting on Saturday, or we'll go do this or that, and I'll give you your allowance and your movie money, and if you don't, I'll whip you and make you do it on Saturday and Sunday." So in verse 16, we learn a little lesson here. It says, "Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the field. Cursed shall be your basket and your store, and cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the fruit of your land, the increase of your kind and the flocks of your sheep. Cursed shall you be when you come in, and cursed shall you be when you go out. And the Eternal shall send upon you cursing, vexation, and rebuke in all that you set your hand to do, until you be destroyed, until you perish quickly, because of the wickedness of your doings, whereby you have forsaken me." Now, I think we Americans can all agree that we're not practicing these laws of the Bible. Christians will tell you plainly, we're not under that law, we're under grace. And they don't get excited about practicing Leviticus 19:19 and concerning hybridization of seed or crossbreeding cattle or cloning cattle, etc. We're not practicing any of these laws. We don't even practice the Ten Commandments. We don't practice the Sabbath. Now, if you'll take a look at international geopolitics, you'll see that America's balance of payments. Take a look at our economics. Take a look at our cities. Are we cursed in our cities? Are we cursed in the field? How about our agricultural exports? Aren't we now approaching parity? That is, we used to be a net agricultural exporter. It contributed to our balance of payments. But today, it's gone from $15 billion in the 90s to $2 billion is what we're expected as a surplus. And in the next 2 years, we're expecting agricultural deficits. We used to be an exporter of wheat. The Russians are coming into the wheat market. The Brazilians are coming into the soybean market. The Chinese are coming into these international markets and displacing us. Are we now being cursed? Verse 21, "The Eternal shall make you," or make the pestilence rather, that's disease, "cleave unto you until he has consumed you from off the land, or you go in to possess it." Have you taken a look at disease in America? Have you considered that in 1900 cancer appeared in 1 in 33 people in the population? Today it's 1 in 2. That's true for every disease that's out there. There's over 400 of them. "The Eternal will smite you with a consumption and with a fever and with an inflammation and with an extreme burning and with the sword and with blasting and with mildew, and they shall pursue you until you perish. And your heaven that's over your head shall be brass, and the earth that's under you shall be iron." Talking about drought. Talking about military reversals. "Now, the Eternal shall make the rain of your land powder and dust. From heaven shall it come down upon you until you be destroyed." Have you heard of El Nino? When I was a kid, we didn't have El Nino. If we did, we didn't know about it. We had bumper crops. I can remember when I was a kid in Kansas, they had so much wheat, they'd have to stack it in the streets. They'd dump it in dump trucks out in the middle of the streets. Didn't have any place else to store it, so they stored it there. You don't see that today, not in the United States. "Now the Eternal will cause you to be smitten before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them and flee seven ways before them, and you shall be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth. Now, that's national captivity. Hasn't happened yet. But let's read on. Just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean that it isn't going to happen. It happened to the Germans in 1945. They went into national captivity. If it can happen to them, could it happen to us? And then your carcass shall be meat unto all the fowls of the air and unto the beasts of the earth, and no man shall fray them away. The Eternal will smite you with the botch of Egypt, and with the hemorrhoids, and with the scab, and with the itch whereof you cannot be healed. These are incurable diseases. The Eternal will smite you with madness and blindness and astonishment of heart, and you shall grope at noonday as the blind gropes in the darkness, and you shall not prosper in your ways, and you shall not only be oppressed and spoiled evermore, but no man shall save you from it. Now that's a pretty serious indictment. Now remember, verse 15 tells you, here's why I'm going to do this to you. You won't practice my laws. Now, we're very concerned about the seatbelt laws and the speeding laws and the traffic laws and the Patriot Act. But we're not very concerned about thou shalt not steal and thou shalt do no murder and, you know, the adultery statutes and so on. Now, this is predicated upon somebody that has the power to actually do this to us. Now, the Chinese have not been able to destroy America. The Russians were not able to destroy America. Germany and the Nazis and the Japanese in World War II were not able to destroy America. But there's a guy here, somebody, in the first person that says, here's what I'm going to do to you. Now remember, we're under a covenant or a contract. And under that covenant or contract, when the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor, for them it was the kiss of death. And that's because the God of heaven, the God of Moses, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has a contract with the descendants of the house of Israel, America, Great Britain, South Africa, Australia, and so on. He said, I'll protect you people. Now, if we don't practice the law of God, then he says he's going to destroy us. And how is he going to do that? Well, listen up, because he says he's going to send a nation whose speech we don't understand, to do it. He says, you shall grope at noonday as the blind gropes in darkness, and you shall not prosper in your ways, and you shall be only oppressed and spoiled evermore, and no man shall save you. Have you taken a look at our balance of payments deficits, and have you taken a look, take a look, at peak oil and our national deficits and our national debt? We're being oppressed. We used to be the world's number one lending nation, creditor nation. Now we're the world's number one debtor nation. Hey, I'd say these prophecies are coming to pass. And it's not just the Americans. It's you Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders right along with us. Verse 30 says, you shall betroth a wife, and another man shall lie with her. Divorce is about 67% here in the United States. You shall build a house and you shall not dwell therein. Have you taken a look at foreclosures in the United States? Highest level of bankruptcies and foreclosures going on right now. And the economy, they tell us, is recovering. Your ox shall be slain before your eyes. You shall not eat thereof. Your ass shall be violently taken away from before your face and shall not be restored to you. Your sheep shall be given to your enemies and you shall have none to rescue them. Have you heard of the IRS? Have you paid attention to the confiscations that go on by government? Do you think that maybe that prophecy is coming to pass? Could it get worse? You know, they're taking 2.5 million children a year out of their homes under the doctrine of parents patriae, put them in foster care, taking your children away from you. Your sons and your daughters shall be given to another people, and your eyes shall look and fail with longing for them all the day long, and there shall be no might in your hand. You know, when the DFS comes in and takes your children away from you, there's just nothing you can do about it, is there? Have you ever thought about that prophecy? In Deuteronomy 28:32. the fruit of your land, and all of your labor shall a nation which you knowest not eat up, and you shall be only oppressed and crushed always, so that you shall be mad for the sight of your eyes which you shall see. The Eternal will smite you in the knees and in the legs with a sore botch that cannot be healed from the sole of your foot to the top of your head. The Eternal will bring you and your king, which you shall set over you, unto a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known, and there shall you serve other gods, wood and stone. You don't want to serve me? Then we'll let you serve the Chinese. And you shall become an astonishment, a proverb, a byword among all the nations where the Eternal shall lead you. When this happens, we're going to become an astonishment. How could this great nation, the United States of America, have been destroyed so suddenly? How could the Western world have been turned upside down, seemingly overnight? You know, you take a look at our demise over the last 50 years. Now, I saw a guy the other day said that along with the ACLU, they're not going to have any prayers or religious teachings in our public schools. Well, okay. That isn't a concept that came from our founding fathers or our Constitution. They all believed fervently in using the Bible, for crying out loud, to teach reading in public school. Today, they don't even want the name Bible in the public school. Well, you shall carry much seed out into the field, and you shall gather but little in, for the locust shall consume it. You shall plant vineyards and dress them, but you shall neither drink of the wine nor gather of the grapes, for the worms shall eat them. You shall have olive trees throughout all of your coasts, but you shall not anoint yourself with the oil, for thine olive shall cast its fruit. You shall beget sons and daughters, but you shall not enjoy them, for they shall go into captivity. All of your trees and the fruit of your land shall the locusts consume. And the stranger that's within you shall get up above you very high, and you shall come down very low. He shall lend to you, and you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. Hey, those Saudis over there are lending us a lot, aren't they? Aren't the Chinese lending us a lot? Aren't the Japanese lending us a lot? Aren't they becoming the head, and aren't we becoming the tail? Now, not all of the prophecies of Deuteronomy 28, all of these statements have come to pass yet, but they're certainly well on their way to fruition. And many of them have and are coming to pass. It's time to make a sudden reversal in policy, but I don't see that the Republicans or Democrats are going to make any sudden reversal in policy, or the ACLU or the education system. Now, do you? I'd say it's time to get ready for these prophecies to be brought to fruition. And the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has said, you know, here's what I'm going to do to you if you don't practice my law. Now, we Americans used to practice the law of God. We taught it in our public schools until 1947. Then we got a bug in our bonnet and said, you know, we're going to go secular and we're going to throw the Bible out of the public educational system. We did. Now, take a look at what's happened from 1947 to today. He said, moreover, all of these curses shall come upon you and shall pursue you and overtake you until you be destroyed, because you hearkened not unto the voice of the Eternal your God to keep his commandments and his statutes which he commanded you. Not only won't we practice the commandments of God in our public schools, we won't practice the commandments of God in our churches either. And we're not ashamed to tell it. We're not under the law, we are under grace. That's Christian philosophy, at least the best from what I can understand of it. And they're telling you plainly, you know, that we're gonna go our own way. We're not going to practice this law. You go to church, and it'll be a rare church that you're going to go to that you'll ever read anything out of the Old Testament, especially anything out of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, or Deuteronomy. That'll be a cold day in hell. He goes on to say, and they shall be upon you for a sign and for a wonder, and upon your seed forever, because you serve not the Eternal your God with joyfulness and with gladness of heart for the abundance of all things. Therefore shall you serve your enemies, which the Eternal shall send against you in hunger and in thirst and in nakedness and in want of all things, and he shall put a yoke of iron upon your neck until he has destroyed you. Now, we're looking at all these cheap imports coming in from China as being a great blessing. I was watching Now the other night with Bill Moyers, and he showed a little clip on there, and this woman said, God, we just love Walmart. It wasn't Bill Moyers, I'll take that back. It was on Frontline. And I run this little clip on there, that a story there on Walmart. And this woman said, I'm going to send my Social Security check and have it direct deposited at Walmart because they've got such low prices, which is a chief contributor, you know, to our balance of payments deficit. Now, this balance of payment deficit is running to a point when it's going to destroy our economy. Well, what's left of it, it's already destroyed, but, you know, you lost 96.5% of your purchasing power. I'd say that's total destruction, but you still got 3.5 cents left, and that's going to be destroyed. Are you paying attention here? This is verse 46, 47. He said, because I gave you all of these great blessings, and you weren't thankful for it, he said, now you'll serve your enemies in hunger and thirst. The Eternal shall bring a nation against you from far, from the end of the earth. China's about as far as you can get. As swift as the eagle flies, sounds like nuclear weapons, a nation whose tongue you shall not understand. Yeah, we don't understand Chinese. A nation of fierce countenance, which shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favor to the young. If there's anybody meaner in the world than the Japanese or the Chinese, you tell me who they are. You remember Bataan and Corregidor? Do you remember the Korean War with the Chinese communists? I mean, those Chinese, they killed 47 million of their own people from 1949 to 57. 50 million of their own people. That's 47 million. A freedom, or a nation rather, of fierce countenance, which shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favor to the young, and he shall eat the fruit of your cattle, the fruit of your land, until you be destroyed, which also shall not leave you either corn, wine, or oil, or the increase of your kine, or the flocks of your sheep, until he has destroyed you. And he shall besiege you in all of your gates until your high towers and fences come down, that's your military establishment wherein you trusted, throughout all of your land. And he shall besiege you in all of your gates throughout all of your land, which the Eternal your God has given you. And you shall eat the fruit of your own body, the fruit of your sons and of your daughters, and of the which the Eternal your God has given you, in the siege and in the straitness wherewith your enemies shall distress you. You know, we're on the verge of going into an economic catastrophe. We got a $550 billion a year balance of payments deficit. What do you think is going to happen when we don't pay and we haven't got the means to pay? Where do you think we're going to get our tennis shoes and our big screen TVs and all of these foodstuffs that are now being imported into the United States? You see, the elements of what you see and read here in Deuteronomy 28 are already in operation against America, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. Now, talking about cannibalism, he says, so that the young man, or so that the man that is tender among you and very delicate, his eye shall be evil toward his brother and toward the wife of his bosom and toward the remnant of his children, which he shall leave, so that he will not give to any of them of the flesh of his own children, whom he shall eat, because he has nothing left him in the siege and in the straitness wherewith your enemy shall distress you in all of your gates. Cannibalism. The tender and delicate woman among you. The New York and Hollywood debutante. The tender and delicate woman among you, which would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground for delicateness and tenderness. Her eye shall be evil toward the husband of her bosom, and toward her son, and toward her daughter, and toward her young one that comes out from between her feet, and toward her children, which she shall bear, for she shall eat them for want of all things secretly in the siege and straitness wherewith your enemy shall distress you in your gates. Sounds like an economic embargo to me. You know, Americans are not of the character that we once were back in the 1930s. I'm not sure that Americans are going to behave like we did in the 1930s. Now, if you will not observe to do all the words of this law that are written in this book that you may fear his glorious and fearful name, the eternal your God. Well, I'm not a preacher. You know, I'm not here to preach Jesus and him crucified to you. I'm just here to point out that international geopolitics and Bible prophecy fit hand in glove. And this prophecy in Deuteronomy chapter 28 is a hair raiser. Then the Eternal will make your plagues wonderful, and the plagues of your seed, even great plagues, and of long continuance, and sore sicknesses, and of long continuance, cancer, heart disease. Moreover, he will bring upon you all the diseases of Egypt, which you were afraid of, and they shall cleave unto you, and also every sickness and every plague which is not written in the book of this law. Them will the Eternal bring upon you until you be destroyed. So he's going to use disease to destroy us along with a foreign nation. And you shall be left few in number, whereas you were as the stars of heaven for multitude, because you would not obey the voice of the Eternal your God. So keep in mind that there's a reason for it, cause and effect. This is the third time in this chapter he said, because you won't practice my law. Now you can sit there and say, like Andy Rooney, he was going over the Ten Commandments, and he said, well, he agreed with murder and theft, he just didn't agree with adultery and a couple, three others. Well, okay. You don't have to agree with these laws. There's nothing personal. God gave us a commandment. Our forefathers said that all that the Eternal has said we will do and be obedient and bound that law upon us, the heirs and the signs forever. Forever isn't up yet. We're the heirs and the signs. We're in breach of contract, and for this breach of contract, here's the penalty. This is the penal clause. National captivity is just part of it. It'll come to pass that as the Eternal rejoiced over you to do you good and to multiply you, so the Eternal will rejoice over you to destroy you. So don't get mad at the communists now. Don't get mad at the Jews and all of the Muslims and the rest of these people around the world that hate us. God is going to use those nations and those people to weaken us, and then he's going to bring this nation from afar, and I'm just saying, I think it's probably the Chinese. A 200 million man army is going to meet in Megiddo in Palestine. And what are they going to be fighting over in the Middle East? Well, don't you think they'll be fighting over the dwindling means of survival? Peak oil? Well, mull it over, you know, just kind of run it through and see what you think of it. Just my common sense says that Bible prophecy, along with what I've just seen here and reported to you, House of Bush and House of Sod, fits together like a hand in a glove. You can get a copy of this book, House of Bush and House of Sod, $26. Remember, it comes from Scribner and Company, copyrighted 2004. The ISBN number was 7432-5337-X. It's about a 1 in 100 read. You'll be looking a long time and reading a lot of books before you read another one. It's a blockbuster, to say the least. Hey, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. There's the signal, says time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.